What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, we are two baby boomers just trying to make sense of this crazy world. I don't know, with our voices, it's really hard, I think, for people to gather a sense because we do look at issues in a very open-minded way. I wonder if people really do think that we're the ages that we are.
Yeah, you wonder. You wonder. But, you know, we really grew up in a crazy world. And, you know, we thought it could never get worse, but I start to wonder sometimes.
I start to wonder myself. But we did live in turbulent times. We really did. And we came through it and became rather conventional in many ways. How do you think our generation, really, John, when you rank us as people look back at this flood of kids from the 50s and 60s, what are they going to say? How are they going to typify our generation?
Boy, that's a good question. That is a good question because, you know, we really, you know, we went from, you know, we got to stick it to the man and then we became the man and we haven't done a very good job at being the man.
Yeah, man, we don't trust anyone over 30, man. I know. And we went from hippies to business types
and
almost
really,
overnight.
We've really failed. I think we would get an F as far as how we've handled the country since we've had control. I mean,
you don't think our presidents of our generation are going to be up on Mount Rushmore?
No, I mean, we've had a few good ones, but, you know, they really haven't. I don't know.
We lost
something in the sauce somewhere.
Right. So we're not going to be competing with the greatest generation.
No.
All right. Fair enough. Though we did make some changes and we brought about some reforms, and that's all good. It really is. But I think it's fair to say that, you know, since we have been the dominant force in this society for such a long time, we were a rebellious lot at one time, and then we got really good educations, and now we're graying.
Yeah, but we're still fighting the wars. Look, we went through Vietnam. We thought, okay, we solved that, and now we're still in these endless wars. I mean, it's just...
Right. Our generation has held on to some of the remnants of that era, even though we said we don't want to make the mistakes that we made in Vietnam.
Peace,
we made them again.
Peace.
Yeah. So listen, you've got parents and grandparents like us who just won't go away. We're staying on the scene for as long as we can because, frankly, we think that death is a terrible alternative to what we've been experiencing.
Stop.
No,
absolutely.
We can't stop.
We can't stop.
So we're
going to
hang
on. Keep on rolling.
We're going to hang on rolling down the river. We're going to keep on hanging on for a little longer. And do you realize, John, that we are part of an incredibly bold experiment that I didn't realize until I talked to our next guest? And that is that, did you realize, John, that we are really part of a bold experiment? And I didn't realize this until I talked to our next guest. We are part of the first moment in the history of the world when there are six generations alive at one time.
Wow. I didn't realize that.
I know.
Six generations at the same time.
Well, you've got the greatest generation.
Right.
Some of
right.
whom,
That's
thank
true.
Goodness, are still with us. The baby boom.
Right.
You've got Generation X. You've
right.
got
the millennials.
You've got Y. And then you've got a new group, I believe he called Alpha. You know, some of the young kids like who are babies.
Gotta start the Alpha.
Exactly. We're starting again. So this is a really incredible moment in time. And it
wow.
would suggest that we've got to get ourselves together and make sure we're on the same
Sounds
page.
Like a song.
Because, what's that?
Get together.
Yeah, well, actually, how about the song, Let's Work Together,
yeah,
Canned Heat, as we're thinking about the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. In fact, I'm going to be playing that song tomorrow
right.
on a little stage,
right.
a very small stage. Well, anyway, that's all right. Hey,
I
never became that rock star I wanted to be. Everybody in the 60s
Everybody
wanted to be a rock star.
Everybody wanted to be in a band,
I
yes.
know. Well, I'm still in a band, but are you sure this is the way the Beatles started? I don't think so. But... Chaim Hering is with us, and he's got an incredible book called Connecting Generations, Bridging the Boomer, Gen X, and Millennial Divide. Now, in this podcast, John, we talk primarily about the millennials and the boomers, because we are the largest of the two cohorts that we're going to be talking about, and we are having the greatest impact. The millennials clearly are going to have to take over a lot of the responsibilities of the boomers, and the boomers, again...
Somebody's got to clean up our mess.
Okay, that's a good way of putting it. It is. And I think it's fair to say that the lines as to who is a millennial are a little bit blurrier than the baby boom set. We kind of know who we are, and we define ourselves pretty clearly.
Right.
Millennials and the ones that are having difficult times, those that might have passed through just ahead of the bust in 2008, I mean, they have some really interesting milestones and benchmarks to their generation. We had many for our own.
Yes.
I mean, recently we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the moonwalk.
Right.
I mean, that was remarkable for our generation. It really was.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was a remarkable time. I mean, we were really shooting up as a country. We were putting satellites up, first coast-to-coast live television shows. I mean, it was just amazing time.
And then we had all the turmoil, as you talked about. Some of it, you know, for the purpose of ending something, which was a war.
Right.
At others, we were looking to start something, which was a civil rights movement. I mean, it really was an interesting time to have been alive.
It was.
But today is too, in many different ways. But we really want to talk about what we have in common, that which divides us, and how we can make things work while coming from such different times and places. And, you know, it's not easy to do that. It really isn't.
No.
And when we think about it, our kids, one of their milestones, of course, is 9/11. And the world before it and the world after it. So, again, we have to be respectful. And they're also looking at their leaders. And they're not thinking about JFK the way we did.
Right. And that's a mistake I think we make a lot of times, is we think that it's even around the world as we think that everybody thinks like us, and that's not the case. They didn't have different experiences
and different points of reference.
Absolutely.
Well, at the outset, I want to suggest, and I think John shares this sentiment with me, I really do like this millennial generation.
Yeah, they're good.
I mean, not only because we have some in our own family that we've created, but I think they're a wonderful generation. But I do think they've got a lot on their plate. I think we've left them with a lot of concerns. But let's see how we can connect these generations. A really important conversation with Chaim Hering today on America Trends.
With us on the line is Chaim Hering, and the book is called Connecting Generations, Bridging the Boomer, Gen X, and Millennial Divide. Let's start off with the premise that there is this divide. And I say that only because Chaim, in the past, I grew up as a baby boomer, of course, and I recall, you know, not trusting anybody over the age of 30. And I just don't feel necessarily that there is this schism between millennials and baby boomers in that same way. I love millennials. I think they're fantastic, personal.
Yeah, I think that puts you in a very distinct minority as a boomer, and I'm right there with you. I think that millennials get a really bad rap from boomers. And what's ironic is that I think that boomers were the one who gave birth to millennials. It's not like we purchased them on Amazon. And to your point, you know, as a fellow boomer, I'm a late boomer, but I still remember the adage, don't trust anyone under 30. Now that we've aged, we're flipping that a little bit, and it's as if we're saying, don't trust anyone under 60. So if boomers can create new off-ramps from work into maybe a couple of decades of productivity, but redefining that differently, why can't we let millennials create new on-ramps to adulthood?
Absolutely. And we'll talk about that and the whole notion of making it a verb and the like. But don't both boomers and millennials consider each other to be entitled? And yet, as you say, we raise them, and we may have sold them that concept ourselves.
Yes. And for me, one of the more fascinating parts of researching this book was asking boomers and millennials the identical question. So when I interviewed a number of boomers. I asked them, when you hear the word millennial, what image or word comes to mind? And when I interviewed millennials, I asked them the same about hearing the word boomer. And here's what they said. And let's get to the issue of entitled and how that's understood differently. So boomers have a bucket list, right? Implying that you work at the same job or, you know, much of your life, if not all of it. And at the end, you get the proverbial golden watch or set of luggage indicating now you can have fun because you own your own time. For millennials, they've critiqued us, and they said, bucket list, I'm going to kick the bucket, and I want to have pleasure now. How do I know what I'm going to be feeling like decades from now? And I don't want to slave away at a job that has no meaning. We are work-obsessed, and we call millennials pleasure seekers. We're goal-driven, and we call millennials snowflakes, which I think is really demeaning, meaning that they have no grit. For boomers, you became an adult within a defined period of time, typically between 19 and 23, and millennials need some time for adulting, practicing it being an adult because they're more along pathways and networks in a very disruptive economy. And if people are living longer, it kind of makes sense that it might take them a little bit longer to grow up.
And I think that's fine. I mean, I think them trying to find themselves over an extended period is great because I think then they come to whatever work or whatever family life they have fully realized in terms of their own agency and what they're about. So I have no problem with that. And in fact, I do think that the way they look at work, which is making it an integrated part of the whole, is a great thing. And I love that notion that you have that if you ask someone who's a millennial whether, in fact, they would exchange 5 years of drudgery for some level of financial freedom, how they respond to that. Explain that to our listeners.
So as a researcher and author, I know it's important to ask questions that you are sure that you're not sure, actually, of the answer to. So I wouldn't ask a boomer, would you have worked at a job for 5 years that had no meaning? Because they did. We did. But I did want to hear from millennials. If I asked them, would you work at 5 years at a job that held no personal meaning, legal job, after which you wouldn't be able to retire, but you would be financially comfortable enough to select any job that you would like for the rest of your life, without thinking across the board, the answer was no. They had a few other choice words, which I can't say on air, but they looked at me quizzically thinking, why would I do that? And of course, that's what boomers did. And I would add one more thing. Many millennials today, when asked, what do you want to do for the next decade or 15 years, get into eye roll mode. And I think that that's just fine, because how can they know what they want to do for a decade when the job that they have 3 years from now may not even exist today?
Exactly. And of course, you talk about the three truths that as a foundation make up the thesis of your book. Number one, we know we need fulfilling relationships across generations. Technology is creating a disconnection for everybody, and it's hard to adapt to the new state of disequilibrium. So with all of that in play, we should really have some understanding. I mean, I have one child who has been pretty settled in his career, one who has continued to search and evolve and get more education and the like. But I know she's on the right path, and it will occur. But for me, I just fell into it a lot more easily than she is able to today. And I understand it's a different work world. It's a different work environment.
It is. But what I found is that many boomers are impatient. They like to impose their own set of values that reflect a different time of life and time in the world. And that's really frustrating for millennials. Now, I would also say that maybe we overcompensated in trying to teach the value of collaboration and everyone's a winner. And that's why you'll hear boomers say, boy, those millennials are really needy. Why is it that they think they want to be CEO on day two of the job? And when millennials talk about boomers being entitled, what they're saying is, we think that just because a boomer has a certain level of seniority or is at a certain age, that person is not automatically entitled to be in charge of a project or an organization. When boomers talk about millennial entitlement, they're pretty much referring to the sense of, you're lucky to have me as an employee. And that's where breaking down these stereotypes and increasing communications, which is a challenge by generation, I think can help to reclaim what is more perennial, that cuts across all generations and the work that we have to do.
Well, one of the things that was a revelation to me in reading your book, Connecting Generations, is the fact that we've got perhaps six generations alive today. And in the workplace, there are many people reluctant to leave the work environment, or they're just not able to because they don't have the resources. When a lot of pensions went dry and when a lot of other guarantees became unguaranteed. So you've got a lot of young people, whatever generation we want to call it, because I know we're talking primarily about millennials and boomers, but Generation Z, X, all of them. And there they are, commingled in the work environment. What is that like? Because I'm not in a work office environment today, but what does that feel like?
Very often conflictual. So there are generational clashes because emails are misunderstood easily. Text messages with emojis are like reading hieroglyphics. And they're good in that they convey some emotional content. But if you don't know how to interpret them, or if you use them, overuse them, as boomers tend to do improperly, what could have been a very simple conversation, either by phone or face-to-face, generates a chain of flying emails of recrimination, misunderstanding, text messages. It's just really difficult in the workplace.
And when you think about all of our reference points, I mean, for many of us, email seems like a revelation. I remember when it came into my work environment years ago, and we thought the first adapter to it, that he was out of his mind. What are you talking about? How are we ever going to look at this? I just can't even understand how difficult it is for somebody my age in a regular work environment today, and virtually everything deals with technology on some level, how they're keeping up with these young people who are natives in this land. Is that one of the things, even though this disequilibrium is happening across generations, to me, it's much more pronounced among those of us who are of a different vintage, another way of looking at perennials, if you will, and the older folks who are listening to us?
Well, antiques can appreciate in value. But I think that boomers tend to close down instead of open up. And they're fearful of new technologies. And this is where I think the potential to break down those stereotypes and really try to identify what communications forms are effective for what situation can be helpful. So, yes, I have actually a unique ability to make my smartwatch look dumb. Right? I'm a little bit slow with my fingers. On the other hand, you can't Google attributes like resilience, tenacity, hope, and things that really reflect a person's life experience. It's not about intelligence, whether it's cognitive or emotional. It's about experience. So if boomers can let go a little bit and be more open to what they can learn in a reciprocal way from millennials, then maybe millennials will relax a little bit and not feel like they're always being judged by boomers.
We're talking, again, a lot about boomers and millennials. But that's because they're such large cohorts, and they're both having such an impact on our society. What about some of these other smaller generations like X, Z? Is there another one out there that I'm forgetting?
Well, Gen Alpha, right? Because what comes after the letter Z? May as well start from the beginning. So I didn't mention this in the book, or perhaps implied it, but I think that the boomer and millennial focus for me was less about boomers and millennials and more about the reality of having so many generations alive in significant numbers at one time. The issues are going to change, but the presence of so many generations means that there will no longer be garden variety generation gaps like we used to have when there were three generations or maybe four. So we've gone from the sandwich generation back in the 80s. Typically that was women who were trying to balance work and caretaking of elderly parents who were not as old and raising children, to what I think is more like a submarine or hoagie, depending upon where you live, meaning that every generation feels different kinds of stress today. There are no exemptions. And that's why I really have come to appreciate the fact that disruption does not discriminate by age. So recognizing that we can move in and out of states of dependency and less dependency at any generational stage, I think is another point of unification among generations.
You say that the labels that we ascribe to each other are really showstoppers, that they stop us from talking. Oh, you're so old and you only like to listen to music from the 1950s or whatever it may be. And you are suggesting that we use a different term, and I referenced it earlier, perennials, rather than, you know, like, what do you think about groups like AARP? Or I know places like the Villages in Florida have to be an anathema in terms of isolating older people. Tell us your thoughts about the way we try to categorize, and many nonprofits do it because they're looking to segment their audiences.
It's both nonprofits and I think people who are marketing products and services. They have a vested interest in trying to identify, to highlight what is different about each generation. And by using a term like perennial, which I was not the first to coin, but I'm using a little bit differently, I think that we can appreciate there are generational differences that we shouldn't ignore. Not everything can be intergenerational, but by continuing to perpetuate labels that create silos across generations, how are we helping one another navigate these turbulent times? So I'm not a gardener, but a friend of mine is. And one day he was describing his perennials, explaining that the top of the plant dies off each winter. What dies off becomes seeds for the next variety of perennials. And those seeds draw upon the same root system. And that image just captured my imagination.
Yeah, I think that is a fascinating way to look at it. You know, I'm thinking about these millennials and younger generations, and there are so many boundaries and so many norms that have been broken wide open that deal with race and sexuality, work-life balance, and they have been blown up. And it may be hard for us as the older generation to understand how little some of those things do mean to them. And, you know, when I think also, even trying to describe young people and what they do, I mean, if you ask certain people, what does your son do or your daughter? And it's a job that they never thought of. It involves some technological advance. You can't even explain what they do. So how do we really begin to meet them on their own terms? Because that job still, to them, means a whole lot. And to us, we can't even explain what it is.
Well, I think that that's a really critical issue. Many of the millennials whom I interviewed said, my parents don't even understand what I do. And I've given up explaining to them. And that, I think, is selling parents a little bit short. Maybe they can't go into all the details, but it's, you know, again, this is part of the instant culture, immediate gratification. There is more impatience on the part of millennials. It's like, now me, And if you don't have time, then I'm out of here. But I also do think that boomers can reach back into their life experiences. And remember, we thought we were exploding stereotypes, which we did.
Right.
And I see a continuity of values. It's just that millennials have means and tools that we didn't to really push the boundary breaking even more.
Of course, as an overarching concept in your book, again, the book is called Connecting Generations, Bridging the Boomer, Gen X, and Millennial Divide. There's something that you talk about that we've talked about on other podcasts. And of course, Robert Putnam described it many years ago in Bowling Alone. And that is the issue of loneliness. And I know that we did a podcast on the fact that a lot of young people are extremely lonely. We know that many older people, particularly men, because we don't set up some of the same networks as women do as we age, that this social isolation, according to a previous Surgeon General, I don't even know if we have one any longer. Maybe the president does that too. But the point is that he said this was the greatest health risk in America today was social isolation, not cancer or the like. So put that in context for us as it relates to the generational divide.
That was one of the findings that actually motivated me to write this book. I was seriously alarmed and really feel a sense of mission and hope other people, regardless of generation, will also feel this, to recognize that we expect elderly people to be lonely on some level, right? Their world begins to get a little bit smaller. Mobility, transportation become issues. But what was really frightening and continues to be is the rate of social isolation, the percentage, the decline of friendships among younger generations for the reason that you said. So if the greatest predictor of longevity is social connectedness, and we see accelerating rates of loneliness and social isolation among the youngest, then extrapolate out a couple of decades and think about both the economic cost, but also the sheer amount of pain that people will be carrying for decades and decades. And that was really so disconcerting. It's like people are retreating more into their devices, and we can change that.
And we'll talk about that, but I want to get back to this notion that my generation, you know, we all like the same music, we all relate to the 1969 landing on the moon, John F. Kennedy is still an exemplar to us, then you have another generation, and they grew up around Watergate. And then 9/11, of course, became a real touchstone to so many. Is that really a point of departure for so many different generations where we can't even imagine? Because if we start talking about the good old days and we start talking about the landing on the moon and they say the moon, well, I know Elon Musk is going to go there, or Jeff Bezos is going to deliver us there in a drone or something. I mean, in other words, how difficult is it when all of our reference points are so different and so divergent, and they've been so cataclysmic in different ways?
That is a real problem. But again, think about how we've managed to isolate generations, even if we look at housing. So people who are older may live in a community campus where there's a continuum of care, from independent to, you know, complete nursing, what we would call nursing home care. And those complexes tend to be away from residential neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So how can people who have been, you know, weaned on certain pivotal events that are different from those of other generations begin to appreciate the changes when there's no organic contact between young and old?
And where we live, there's a university that's been trying to bridge that with a lot of programming that is intergenerational. There's a program at the University of Connecticut on one of their campuses that tries to involve the campus kids at the same time that they have this Osher Lifelong Learning Institute and bringing together the generations. There's a community that's growing in one of our suburban sectors here in the state of Connecticut where they are purposely putting together different generations to care, to do daycare for the working mothers. You have elderly women and men. So, I mean, is this one of the things we really need to start doing as we're building some new relationships and environments going forward?
Yes, those are really exciting trends happening in the marketplace. And I think that that's where I'm pinning more of my hopes, because I'm certainly not going to wait for Congress to act and think intergenerationally. That would require some optimism that at the moment is not warranted.
However, really interesting though, I mean, let's look at Congress, and you've got a Nancy Pelosi who is about 78, and she's got a band of really interesting saboteurs who are much younger, and she's having to negotiate with them. So in a sense, we're watching that generational divide play out in Congress itself.
Yes, we are, and my next area of research will be, what does it mean to have presidential aspirants from three different generations and an age span of 40 plus years? I don't recall a time like that before.
No, and I love
the millennials, Gen X, and boomers. Yeah.
I love the way Pete Buttigieg is using that, saying, hey, look, you know, we have to deal with these problems going forward. You don't. And it reminded me in one of the podcast opens that we did, I said to John, here's a revolutionary idea that instead of worrying about young people voting, how about people age 60 and up can't vote because they're not going to be around to worry about the long-term consequences. I was being, you know, a little light in that. But nonetheless, I think he makes a good point that if you don't believe in climate change, well, you don't have to worry about it as much as perhaps another generation does.
Well, I thought you were going to say that we should get Elon Musk to put boomers on a one-way ticket to the moon.
Well, he's ready to go to Mars, so he's taking it even further.
But I think that's a fair point, because if you want to talk about the future and you want to think about it, then why can't we have more younger people who will be spending more time in the future directly involved in problem solving? I think that's a pretty fair point that Buttigieg makes.
But are we reluctant to give it up? I mean, baby boomers. I mean, many are staying in the workforce, reluctant and sometimes unable really to leave yet. I mean, what is the willingness? Because, you know, baby boomers, as you said earlier, were looked upon early on as being kind of problem children. And in many cases, I used to hear that millennials were being compared to the greatest generation, which as we record this today is on D-Day, and we're reflecting back on their contributions. So I don't know where the millennials have gotten this bad rap, in a sense, because they were being compared not to us, the baby boomers, but to the greatest generation at one point.
And there is a lot of optimism still among millennials about changing the world, not giving up. And I think I find that very inspirational. And I think when we look at the generation below, when we get to Gen Z, they're going to also shatter some stereotypes, and they're going to compete differently with millennials. I mean, millennials grew up, again, thinking that any company that hires me is lucky to have me. And for Gen Z, it's more because of what they saw happen to their parents, loss of homes, loss of jobs, I mean, total collapse of economy. Their feeling is, I'm lucky to have a job. So that's going to create a different dynamic. And I think that if we can discard some of the labels, just put them aside for a moment and really think about what it is that we all hope to do, which is to relinquish those values and habits that have held back our potential, and to give, to take those seeds that we're still working and still have new life in them, and let the next generations carry them forward. That's been the true cycle of life. And we've lost that.
The quote that you have in the book from Shimon Peres about separation between generations being greater than between nations, That was a stunner to me.
I love that quote because it came from someone who was over 90 years old at the time, which again explodes some stereotypes. If you connect with people across generation, then your mind, if it's, you know, still functioning well, can be very vital. And for him to have an insight that the biggest divide is not across nations, but it's across generations, again, I think is a very optimistic sign about what can be.
One of the things that you recommend is what you call reciprocal mentoring. Explain that.
A friend and a colleague of mine, Stuart Himmelfarb, who actually does some work around boomers, made me aware of that phrase. And it arose from a trip that he had been taking for 10 or 11 years. It was an organically organized group of, I believe, men or perhaps men and women, I don't recall all the details, but who wanted to address Hurricane Katrina and not forget that that was a calamity that happened that was neglected and out of the spotlight. So it was a group of people who self-organized across generations, and suddenly age didn't matter. It was who had what skill to get the job done. And that's where reciprocal mentoring comes in. What is it that we can contribute collectively across generations that we can't do only by working with those intergenerations? There are certain dividends that happen by being intergenerational, and that is valuing and prioritizing what each generation has to offer to the other, feeling a shared stake of success in each generation, as opposed to multi-generational, which is just the number of generations, but not a value.
I love the way you make that distinction in the book. And I really want to recommend this book because in each chapter, you've got these wonderful suggestions as to how we can bridge the gap between the various age groups. You've got a lot of other information. It really is chock full. And there's one thing that you have, which is called a Family Technology Action Plan. What is that, and why do we need one?
Very often we hear that it's much harder today raising children because of the, I guess, technology is pretty much embedded and increasingly so in everything that we do. So I spoke with an expert who works with parents, children, and also grandparents, because being a grandparent today is a different experience, and challenged her with the question, is it harder today to be a parent because of technology? The Family Action Technology Plan is part of her response, which is not really, because every generation has had to grapple with the impact of new technologies on families. And the role of parents, and I would also add grandparents who are increasingly active in their grandchildren's lives for many, is to help set boundaries, to guide children through different technologies, and to make them secure and safe, and also open and curious and to know how to use what's out there, because they're going to learn anyway. So that's why having a plan that can help structure the use of technology so that it's a platform for connection and not isolation is so critical.
In closing, is there one generation that is less receptive to sharing, to reaching out? Is it old to young, young to old? Or does it really just depend on the circumstance? Or is it really that perhaps society hasn't woken up to the sixth generation, matrix that we now have, and hasn't really encouraged this because we're so busy living our lives and often segmenting ourselves by age, by race, by neighborhood, community, whatever it may be?
I don't think that any generation has a monopoly on age segregation, but I think that there are so many other isms right now that one that's really prevalent that has slipped under the radar is the way that we've segregated ourselves by age. And I think it's a structural problem that we have to deal with. It can be dealt with through housing, through education, in the way that you described with colleges, actually building either senior housing or offering intergenerational classes through volunteer work. There are ways that we can do it that actually don't cost any additional money. It's a reprioritization of values.
You're absolutely right. My wife is working in this gardening program where the fruits of it all go to soup kitchens and the like here in our community. And the young people from the high schools and the colleges come and work with seniors to get that done. So you're right. I mean, it's a lack of imagination, or perhaps it's a lack of thinking that this is another one of those issues that we really do need to address to maximize our potential in this society. But you do such a great job, I am hearing, in this book, Connecting Generations, Bridging the Boomer, Gen X, and Millennial Divide. And again, you get into hard trends, and we really appreciate it on America Trends that you came by today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate it.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.